Right, like I mentioned a moment ago, just for those of you who pick up this message as a recording, we're not around next Sabbath, so there'll be no Bible study from the UK next Sabbath. Okay, as you know, for the last few weeks, we've been reviewing the topic of prophecy, spending quite a bit of time in particular in the book of Daniel. And we've said it's probably important that you and I be quite familiar with the narrative, what the scriptures actually say, the words, the pictures, the symbols. When it comes to considering what those symbols might mean, sometimes it's actually stated. At other times, we are trying to use a bit of wisdom, common sense, and obviously, we have to be a wee bit cautious as we start to do that. We've also spent some time sort of comparing, shall we say, the more traditional understanding probably most of us have had, which is that when you're reading through Daniel and Revelation and other places it's pointing to, it's picturing in the end time the restored Holy Roman Empire in some way. We're looking towards Rome and or Europe, 10 countries in Europe which will unite, and in some way the Vatican, the Roman Catholic Church, will be working closely with those and will initiate the Great Tribulation. That's traditionally, I guess, where most of us have come from. We're suggested as a possible, but I think quite plausible alternative, and I think actually a more plausible alternative, is that perhaps we should be looking towards the Islamic realm for the fulfillment of these prophecies. You know, most of us, to some extent at least, like to watch world conditions and check out what's happening in the light of our understanding of prophecy. Should we look, therefore, exclusively at Europe and Rome, the Vatican? I think that would be dangerous. In addition, of course, in many ways, not a huge amount, really, has happened over there in the last sort of few decades. And so I've suggested again that perhaps if we are seeking to watch world news and be alert to the journey through prophecy, perhaps again looking to the Middle East, to Iran and Iraq and Turkey, perhaps that might be an area that's also well worth looking to. And in terms of understanding the narrative, hopefully by now we can all recognize, if we said, what's in Daniel chapter 2? We might all hopefully say, oh, the statue in four metals, hopefully. If we said, what's in Daniel 8? Hopefully, most of us would get to, that's the ram, isn't it, that charges about, and then gets attacked by the he-goat. And we've said, looking at Daniel 8 in more detail, that suggests that Iran will go out on a rampage sometime fairly soon, and that Turkey, after a while, will retaliate, leading a confederacy of four nations. We looked at the narrative of Daniel 9, the so-called 70 weeks prophecy, and we saw in there that there's certainly a strong indication that one end-time leader, often known as the Antichrist, will initiate a seven-year covenant or treaty with Jerusalem, but renege halfway through it, erect an abomination of desolation, and thereby trigger the last 3.5 years, the tribulation. But we said also that the traditional view is that he who confirms that covenant in Daniel 9 is potentially, possibly, I'm not at all persuaded, Jesus Christ, who confirms a covenant for 7 years, the first 3.5, and then somewhere along the line, another 3.5 years. So again, hopefully the narrative, the 70 weeks and how it plays out, that should be something we hopefully are a bit more familiar with than perhaps 3 or 6 months ago. And last week we started in Daniel chapter 7 and the four beasts there, and we'll go there in just a few minutes. But before I get to opening the Bible, there's some background information I'd like to share about Islam. I meant to do it last week, ran out of time. In the notes from the week before, when I also ran out of time, so I thought this week I'll do it first, so at least I'll get rid of it. So I don't know how much you know about Islam as a religion or as a political organization, but here's some bits and pieces, a bit disjointed maybe, but just give you a flavor for what's behind Islam. So various facts and figures, there are about roughly 1.67 billion Muslims on the earth, which is roughly 25%. Islam is the fastest growing religion on the earth, and growing means growing. It's not static, it's not diminishing, it's growing by a combination of birth. Many more Muslim babies are born, or babies are born who become Muslim, and also by conversion. Many people, strangely enough, I find it strange, but it happens, are converting to Islam. In the USA, numbers are a wee bit difficult to come by, but it appears to be approximately, roughly, 100,000 conversions a year to the Muslim faith in the US of A. And remarkably, 80% of those are people who were Christians, or at least raised in a Christian church. Quite surprising. How many Muslims are there around? Well, we know how many there are worldwide, not far off 2 billion. In the UK, where I'm based, about 3 million. Most of those are in England. Not so many in Scotland, probably a bit too cold up there for them. And in the USA, a bit less than that, actually. The official number is about roughly 2.5 million in the USA, although unofficial numbers suggest maybe as many as 7 million. And most of those tend to be in the bigger cities. New York City has around 700,000, Chicago around 350,000. In the EU, the European Union area, there are approximately 20 million Muslims. Most are in Germany and France. They've got the biggest numbers, at least. Okay, that's the numbers we're talking about, so it's pretty big, and they're in lots of places. There are two main divisions in Islam. There are those who are the Sunnis. That's typically written S-U-N-N-I. Yes, the Sunnis, they represent about 85% of Muslims, and the bulk of the rest, about 15%, are Shias, typically S-H-I-A-S, or the Shiites. And that's a split that's been around since almost day one. It goes back about 1,400 years, and it's the usual sort of thing. Muhammad died, there was a big bust-up about who would be his appointed successor. And so most went one direction with a particular guy, and a whole bunch of others went a different direction, and they started fighting and killing, and have been doing it pretty much ever since. I think we've all seen that. We can all think Mr. Herbert Armstrong dies, and you get a bit of a bust up about who should be his successor, who should wear the mantle. And of course you go, who knows, 300 or more Churches of God lurking about. Well, Islam has a bit of that. The Shias and the Sunnis. The Sunnis, the vast majority, 85%. Iran, which is the Ram of Daniel 8, old Persia, is mostly Shia. So it's in the minority, because the vast majority, like a Saudi, like a Turkey, like most other countries, are Sunnis. And, of course, that sort of hostility between the Shias and the Sunnis may be behind Daniel 8's reference to Iran rushing out on the rampage to dominate. That may be partly the Shias seeking to, if you like, elevate their version of Islam as being superior. So there's a lot of jealousy, envy, hostility there. Okay, moving on another bit. Pretty much all Muslims believe that the ultimate goal for planet Earth is to become entirely Muslim. That is Allah's will. And they are taught and believe, pretty much, that until the whole world is Muslim, you won't actually have world peace. So ultimately, Islam is expected to dominate the whole world. That's what Allah wants. If you're a true Muslim, that's what you expect ultimately will come to pass. And there's two different approaches to how you're going to get there. There's a revolutionary approach and the evolutionary approach. The revolutionary approach basically is, America's the great Satan. Let's get our swords, our bombs. Let's go out there and wage the jihad of battle. Let's force Islam on the world. Let's kill, destroy, obliterate all the non-Muslims, unless they convert. And, of course, people like, say, ISIS, notorious for their fighting, for their bombing, for their beheadings, they are in the forefront of the revolutionary approach to bringing Islam to rule the world. The other approach, the more common one, is evolutionary. That is simply, let's give it time. Because time is on our side. We are growing in numbers as Muslims. We are bringing people in through conversion. Little by little, we will bring most countries under the banner of Allah over time. We don't need to go around, killing and maiming and bombing. It'll just happen because it's a numbers game. And of course, behind that, there's things like lots of migration of Muslims into the UK, into Europe, into the US of A. In these countries, typically, Muslim families are bigger. They tend to have more babies. And, of course, they do seek to influence the countries they come into in peaceful ways, but there's an ultimate expectation. And so Muslims very often occupy key positions in government, in the media, in universities, in education. You get many departments of Islamic studies set up at leading universities, funded typically by the Saudi Arabians, and they just ensure that the opportunity to, I'll use the words, evangelize the Muslim faith is there. And newspapers, TV companies, leading politicians, they hope over time to influence the countries they're in to accept, to eventually admire, and ultimately to see many, many conversions to the Muslim faith until eventually it becomes the dominant faith. I've heard a guy say that the Saudi Arabians, who are sort of close partners with the US of A, the Saudis have said that they expected a few years ago to see the US of A become a Muslim country in 150 years. And they're prepared to wait that long. The evolutionary approach is happy to wait, and it'll just, eventually time will win. Well, apparently the Saudis have revised that number, and apparently they now expect the US of A to be a Muslim country within 30 years. 30 years. 30 years. That's their expectation. Okay. Let's move on a little bit. More of this disjointed information I'm trying to share. Now, to be fair, I guess I need to emphasize this. Most everyday Muslims that you and I come across would fall into the latter approach. Not out to, kill and bomb you. They're just people that believe over time, either in the next generation or the one after, that the UK and the US of A and Canada will ultimately become dominantly Muslim countries. So they're not personally violent people, your neighbours, the people you might, work with. They're fairly ordinary people, most of them. They got families, they got careers, They're probably not that much different in many ways to your average Protestant, average Catholic. They have a faith. They might be a little bit ignorant of some of the teachings. They might be sort of fairly lukewarm, like most Catholics are, most Protestants are. And to be fair, you know, most Muslims that you'll meet in the supermarket or serving in a, you know, Tim Hortons or some other coffee shop, these are going to be generally, you know, decent people. Just a different faith than you've got. And, of course, they're spiritually in darkness. You know, Satan has deceived them. But, of course, they all expect ultimately that their faith, Islam, will dominate the whole world. It's just they're not people who are going to go out and kill to make it happen. They just expect over time the purity and truth of the Islamic faith will win over all the current non-Muslims like you and me. However, of course, there are some extremely devout activist-type Muslims, and they intend to get out there and make it happen a lot sooner. They're in the forefront, the vanguard. And they're the ones that, for example, would populate ISIS and carry out the things that we deem to be atrocities, but they see as the march of Islam. How many of those are there? I don't know. But if you said, let's say, just 1%, you know, 1 in 100, 1%, well, that would come to about 17 million on the earth, which is a big number if they're literally prepared to go out and kill. And in Europe, that 1% would be approximately 200,000. Okay, maybe it's only 0.5%. Well, that's still a big number. So I guess most of us don't need to live in fear of any, you know, next-door neighbours who might be Muslim or a co-worker or a server in Starbucks. But nonetheless, all of them, whether they're revolutionary or evolutionary, they ultimately expect Islam will be the world's most dominant religion, and only then will the world have peace. Okay, move on to the next little disjointed part. In terms of the holy books of Islam, there are really three sort of key texts that they use to conduct their lives and to establish their doctrine. The most famous one, of course, is the Quran. And you can spell that two ways, typically Q-U-R-A-N or K-O-R-A-N, any other way you want, really. There's also the Sirah, S-I-R-A, typically, or the Hadith. H-A-D-I-T-H. These are three main texts. The Quran is their, I guess, their really holy book. The Quran is the message that Allah gave to the angel Gabriel, which the angel Gabriel gave to Muhammad. The Quran. So it's Allah's words to Gabriel, to Muhammad, a revelation that came over about 23 years. But unfortunately, or fortunately, or whatever way you look at it, the Quran isn't big enough to give you sufficient information to cover all aspects of your life. So a good Muslim who wants to live like a good Muslim needs further information, which comes from the Sirah, S-I-R-A, which is Muhammad's biography. Very important. If you're a true, genuine Muslim, you must be a follower of the example of Muhammad, God's messenger, Allah's messenger. And of course, in the biography, you find out what Muhammad did. So, great help. And the third bit is the Hadith. And these are the traditions which belong to Muhammad. Between these three books, there's plenty of information to help you be a good and successful Muslim. Now, the Quran is a strange book. It is apparently deliberately organized to be difficult to understand. In other words, it's not to be easily understood, and that's a deliberate way it's done, because the Quran is organized so that the longest chapters come first in the Quran, and then the next longest, and then the next longest, and the next longest, all the way down to the shortest. So it doesn't, there's no theme in that sense. It doesn't start at the beginning and go to the end. It's not chronological. It's very repetitive in places, but essentially you start with chapter 1 being the longest and chapter 2 a little bit shorter and all the way down to the end of it. So if you just try reading from the beginning to the end, it's hopelessly confusing. It makes almost no sense just to read it. You have to be really educated in how to read it. And then the other thing about the Quran is it has got many, many contradictions. Now, many people say, of course, the Bible's got contradictions, but you can pretty much explain those and show that they're just misunderstandings. But the Quran does have contradictions, and they're accepted as contradictory by the Muslims. But then how you deal with the contradictions is they have something called the law of abrogation. The law of abrogation, to abrogate, is to do away with something, to abrogate it, to do it away. And what the background here is to understanding the Quran, this part of it, is that Muhammad, developed his revelation over a couple of decades, and it is believed by the Muslims that his later understanding is more accurate than his early understanding. So as the 20-odd years went on, he came to have a better grasp of the teachings of Allah than when he started. And that means that anything that comes later overturns anything that was said earlier. So the earlier revelations of Muhammad, if they contradict the latter stand, the earlier ones are abrogated. They are done away with. But of course, since the Quran's not in chronological order, how do you know what came later and what was earlier? Well, that's where you have to be really educated in the Quran. And so the top teachers in Islam, the imams and so on, they know how to do that, how to identify the earlier from the latter. And what you find is that in the earlier revelations in the Quran, Muhammad's a bit more tolerant. Early in his life, he still was trying to sort of persuade Jews and Christians to sort of join him. He's much more open and tolerant of their existence. But as he matured and got older, he became much harsher, much more dictatorial, far less willing to allow any opposition. And so the latter parts of the Quran are really quite tough. And what that means, in a sense, is that it is possible to select from different parts of the Quran to suit your purpose. And, for instance, that's something you need to watch out for. There was this jihadist attack in Paris back in, was it November?
November.
129 or so killed one Friday night in restaurants, at a music event and so on, all by Islamic jihadists, obviously of the revolutionary sort, out to kill and and so on. And what happened was a lot of the newspaper accounts pointed out that this is not really genuine Islam, because we all know Islam is a religion of peace. And then they would quote parts of the Quran saying just how tolerant Islam was of other faiths. But actually, in reality, if you would check, you'd find that that's from the early part of Muhammad's life and has been abrogated, done away with by the latter parts. So although they can quote the Quran, those portions of the Quran actually have no validity. So you can quote it, means nothing at all. Here's a couple of quotes for you. The verse that you often get, you often see in newspaper accounts about just how tolerant Islam is of others, and therefore it's a peaceful religion, is chapter 2, verse 256, it says, of the Quran, and it says, "Let there be no compulsion in religion." That's just a snippet. It means, obviously, people can choose what they want to believe. not compelling anybody to join Islam, because Muhammad said in the Quran, let there be no compulsion in religion. And that's in the Quran, chapter 2. But it turns out that's an early saying of Muhammad. And later verses, regrettably, abrogate that. It's nullified. Because later on in, say, chapter 9, it says, fight those who believe not in Allah nor the last day, nor hold that forbidden which has been forbidden by Allah and his messenger, until they pay the jizya, which is a tax, with willing submission and feel themselves subdued. Well, to paraphrase that, get out there and fight non-Muslims. And if they're Jews or Christians, if they are willing to pay the tax and humiliate themselves and become second-class citizens, you can let them live. But only as second-class citizens. So the first part about no compulsion, sorry, abrogated. The latter revelation is fight those who believe not in Allah. So, you know, the Quran actually says that the good Muslims, faithful Muslims, should actually fight by any means to establish Islam around the world. One commentator says, most Islamic scholars say that one verse of the Quran, 9:5, chapter 9, verse 5, abrogates 124 verses which basically dealt with peace and forgiveness. So, you see, people can pull out, if they're Islamic apologists, these verses about Muhammad, tolerance, forgiveness, peace. But the scholars themselves say, well, actually, chapter 9, verse 5, which is known as the verse of the sword, which might give you a clue, abrogates all these verses about live and let live. And chapter 9, verse 5 says, when the forbidden months are past, then fight and slay the pagans wherever you find them. Seize them, beleaguer them, lie in wait for them in every stratagem of war. That's what you got to do. That's Allah. That's his commandment. Get out there and fight them anywhere and everywhere and slay them. But if they repent, in other words, become Muslims, and establish regular prayers and practice regular charity, then open the way for them. For Allah is oft forgiving, most merciful. Chapter 9, verse 5. So if you become a Muslim, yeah, it's fine. If you don't, if you're a Jew or a Christian, you might be allowed to pay the tax and accept second class status, where you won't get a good job. Your opinion won't stand up in court. But in most cases, you'll actually have to become a Muslim or die. And so when you get politicians and the media saying after some atrocity, we shouldn't blame Islam, it's a religion of peace, well, they're either not being honest or they know what they're talking about and they're just trying to avoid causing further problems by being inflammatory. Okay, so that's the question about the Quran, the way it's organized, it's confusing, and the law of abrogation is vitally important. So don't be fooled when you get some quotation from the Quran about peace and love and goodwill to all men. It's really not there at the end of the book. And one last thing to watch out for, and we'll open our Bibles in a moment, is the sort of nonsense you hear about we all worship the same God. We do not all worship the same God. You know, that Islam and you know, Christianity in the broader sense, we all worship the same God. No, we don't. We don't. There's a track you can find on YouTube of Mr. Bush Jr., being asked that question, do we all worship the same God? He said, oh, yes, I believe we do. He says there are different routes, or I guess in America, routes, to God. But yeah, we all worship the same God. Mr. Bush, we don't worship the same God. You know? Allah is not the God of the Bible. They are not the same. He was asked, Mr. Bush Jr., Do you believe that good Muslims will be in heaven? Oh, yes, I do.
Well, he's wrong.
I'm sorry. Well, I'm not sorry at all. I mean, but he's wrong. So when somebody says to you, well, we all worship the same God, just different routes to get there. No, 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 we don't. If there's one religion on the earth which is riddled through and through with the spirit of Antichrist, it is Islam. Let's open our Bibles at 1 John chapter 2, rehearse some things we covered 3 or 4 weeks ago. 1 John 2, read verses 18 and 22. If you want to know who Allah is, it's Satan. Simple as that.
Well, that
1.67 billion people worship Satan and are in captivity to him. And that's a shame for them. And so we shouldn't, you know, in that sense, you know, look down on them or because they're in the dark, as you and I, you know, once upon a time were. But they're in a lot of darkness in their case. 1 John 2, verse 18 and then 22. Little children, says John, it is the last hour. And as you've heard that the Antichrist is coming, even now many Antichrists have come, by which we know that it is the last hour. There's nothing new about an Antichrist, at least the spirit of such. Look at verse 22. Who is a liar, but he who denies that Jesus is the Christ, or that Jesus is the Messiah? In other words, the promised Savior of the world. If you deny that, you're a liar. But notice it continues, he is Antichrist who denies the Father and the Son. If you deny God the Father and his Son, Jesus the Messiah, you are an Antichrist. Look at 1 John 4, read verses 2 and 3. 1 John 4, verses 2 and 3. By this you know the Spirit of God. Every spirit that confesses that Jesus Christ has come in the flesh is of God. And every spirit that does not confess that Jesus Christ has come in the flesh is not of God. And this is the spirit of the Antichrist, which you have heard was coming and is now already in the world. You know, the spirit of Antichrist was around in John's day, probably fairly small numbers, bearing in mind it was, you know, maybe 90 AD or something and not that many folk around at all. But now we're talking of, you know, 1.67 billion. Now look at 2 John, chapter 1, verse 7. 2 John. There's only one chapter, but reading verse 7. For many deceivers have gone out into the world who do not confess Jesus Christ as coming in the flesh. This is a deceiver and an antichrist. You deny the Father and his Son, spirit of Antichrist. You deny Jesus is the promised Messiah who shed his blood to atone for the sins of the world. You are Antichrist. And I'm not afraid, I keep saying things like that, but
I'm not afraid.
One of the most fundamental teachings of Islam is that Allah has no son. To Muslims, that is blasphemous. They do believe in Jesus, so again, watch out for that. When they talk about Jesus, they don't mean our Jesus, because their Jesus was not the Son of God. Their Jesus was merely a fleshly prophet. And their Jesus, the fleshly prophet and only fleshly prophet, did not get crucified. He did not die. So I'll read a couple of verses here from the Quran. Because it's in the holy book, the Quran, and it says in chapter 19, those who say the Lord of mercy has begotten a son preach a monstrous falsehood, at which the very heavens might crack, the earth split asunder, and the mountains crumble to dust. When they should ascribe a son to the merciful, when it does not become the Lord of mercy to beget one. Obviously the language is a bit stilted, but basically, if you say that Allah has begotten a son, that is a monstrous falsehood. It says later on in that chapter, it is not befitting to Allah that he should beget a son. Or, from chapter 9, Christians call Christ the son of Allah. Well, of course, we usually use the term God, but anyway. Christians call Christ the son of Allah. That is a saying from their mouth. In this, they but imitate what the believers of old used to say, Allah's curse be on them. They are deluded from the truth. So to call Christ the son of God, may Allah's curse be on you. And then again, talking of the Jews, so referring to what the Jews were saying, the Quran says, they said in boast, we killed Christ Jesus, son of Mary, the messenger of Allah. And it continues, but they killed him not, nor crucified him, but so it was made to appear to them, for of a surety they killed him not. So the picture there is that there was some sort of a mirage, and the real Jesus actually never died. So therefore, you know, you and I have no Savior. Jesus wasn't the Son of God, not Savior. It's nonsense. So, you know, talk of the spirit of Antichrist on the earth today, I mean, it's all the way through Islam. It's fundamental. To them, it's blasphemy. As we said before, if you compare, say, Rome, Europe, sort of the Catholic realm, Protestant realm, about what they say, well, you know, most of the Christians, using the term loosely, in Europe, North America, Catholic or Protestant, they believe that God is the Father. They believe that Jesus is the Son of the Father. There might be a lot of other things that we dispute with them, but that part. So if you're looking at, you know, who most looks like the Antichrist type of person, I think Islam, far better bet than, shall we say, you know, Europe and Catholicism. Right, let's move on. Daniel 7, verses 1 to 14. So we're trying to build a picture up of the last, you know, 5 or 6 weeks or whatever, that although we're not dismissing entirely the European Rome type of you know, outline, it has quite a few problems, and Islam has got, I think, fewer and does seem to fit a lot better. So we're now in Daniel, reading about the four beasts in Daniel chapter 7. So let's read through from verse 1. In the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, Daniel had a dream and visions of his head while on his bed. Then he wrote down the dream, telling the main facts. Now, we said last week, this is in the reign of Belshazzar. Belshazzar was the last king of Babylon, and he brought to an end the kingdom of Babylon. He was killed by the invading Medo-Persians. All right? So later on, we'll see a verse that talks about when these four beasts shall arise. You think, well, what, Babylon shall arise? It's just about finished. So that suggests this whole passage is really all future and not referring to necessarily ancient Babylon at all. Picking up in verse 2, Daniel spoke, saying, I saw my vision by night, and behold, the four winds of heaven were stirring up the great sea, and four great beasts came up from the sea, each different from the other. The first was like a lion, had eagle's wings. I watched till its wings were plucked off, and it was lifted up from the earth and made to stand on 2 feet like a man, and a man's heart was given to it. Now, this in a sense is Babylon in terms of identifying it, but of course Babylon today, if this has a future fulfillment, which I'm going to suggest it does have, is of course Iraq. So therefore, if we see this vision being future, or a long way future to Daniel at least in our time today, then the lion or Babylon is modern day Iraq. Verse 5, and suddenly another beast, a second like a bear, It was raised up on one side, had three ribs in its mouth between its teeth, and they said thus to it, our eyes devour much flesh. Okay, so the bear would appear to be Medo-Persia, or what we call today Iran. The bear has obviously two sides, but one side is raised up higher than the other. And we said, well, you know, the bear appears to be, if it's Persia, if it's Iran, then it's mentioned the next chapter, chapter 8, as the ram. The ram had two horns, one of which came up later and became bigger. So, well, okay, that sounds quite close. The bear's got one side and the other. The ram, which is the same nation, Iran, has got one horn longer than the other. The ram went out and attacked in three directions, north, south, and west. The bear has three ribs, perhaps stuck in its mouth, pointing in three directions. Who knows? Verse 6, after this I looked and there was another like a leopard, which had on its back four wings of a bird. The beast also had four heads, and dominion was given to it. Well, again, what comes after the Medo-Persia was often referred to as Greece, but probably ethnically and geographically today more like our Turkey. And of course, in Daniel 8, we seem to have the he-goat with the notable horn charging at and devastating the ram. So that appears to be modern-day Turkey leading a confederation of four nations as it counterattacks Iran. We've been through that, so I'm not belaboring that. But again, look at the verse 6. The leopard has four heads, four nations which unite as a confederacy, headed up by almost certainly Turkey. Four wings of a bird, that might relate to just the sheer speed of this particular attack, or maybe perhaps, but less so, might picture more of an airborne attack. And notice that the Iraq, the lion, is Muslim. The bear, Iran, is Muslim. The leopard, Turkey, is Muslim. Now we come to the fourth beast, verse 7. Is it going to be Western Europe? Christian Europe? So Muslim, professing Christian Europe. Doesn't really, to me, feel very consistent. But anyway, verse 7. After this is on the night visions, and behold, a fourth beast, dreadful, terrible, exceedingly strong. It had huge iron teeth. Well, you know, fourth empire of Daniel 2 was iron. It was devouring, breaking in pieces, and trampling the residue with its feet. It was different from all the beasts that were before it, and it had 10 horns. I was considering the horns. And there was another horn, a little one, coming up among them, before whom three of the first horns were plucked out by the roots. And there in this horn were eyes like the eyes of a man, and a mouth speaking pompous words, great things. So, right, okay. What's this fourth and a terrible beast? Well, the 10 horns, we know are 10 kingdoms. We'll tell that later on. So 10 horns are 10 kingdoms. But then another little horn pops up. Pompous, arrogant individual or power source who plucks up three of them. Now, our traditional view that we were have grown up with pretty much is that this fourth dreadful beast is the Roman Empire. And the little horn is the papacy, the Vatican. That's what most of us have believed in, and possible, but I'm not going to go over all the reasons already said why identifying the fourth empire as Rome really, to me, just doesn't work for all the reasons we've covered endlessly in the past 6 weeks. And again, just notice one of them here. It says in verse 7, it says this fourth terrible beast was devouring, breaking in pieces, and trampling the residue with its feet. Did Rome ever do that historically? We've said, no, it didn't. It did not break in pieces. It didn't pulverize. It didn't smash. It defeated you. But then it often added roads and bridges and viaducts and enabled quite a lot of law and order. As long as you provided your taxes and swore loyalty to the Caesar, actually, it wasn't too bad. So Rome really doesn't fit. So the other alternative we've suggested is that perhaps what we're looking at here is, of course, the Islamic empire at the end of time with a Islamic Antichrist governing it, the little horn. Drop down to verse 11. I watched then because of the sound of the pompous words which the little horn was speaking. I watched till the beast was slain, his body destroyed and given to the burning flame. As for the rest of the beasts, so this implies it all existing together, doesn't it? It's not like one was Babylon of, you know, 3,000 years before, and one was Persia of 2,000 years earlier. It says, as for the rest of the beasts, verse 12, so they're all alive at this time. They had their dominion taken away, yet their lives were prolonged for a season and a time. So all four must be around in the end time. I was watching in the night visions, and behold, one like the Son of Man coming with the clouds of heaven. He came to the Ancient of Days, the Father. They brought him near before him. Then to him, Jesus, was given dominion and glory and a kingdom that all peoples, nations and languages should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion which shall not pass away. His kingdom, the one which shall not be destroyed. So it takes us all the way down through these four beasts right up to the return of Jesus Christ and the establishment of the kingdom, which of course is quite similar to Daniel 2 and the statue, which takes you all the way down to when the great stone is cut out, smashes the statue on its feet, and the stone expands and fills the earth. That's God's kingdom. So we can see that this prophecy takes us all the way to the end of this age. All right. Okay, let's read Daniel 7, verses 15 to 17. I, Daniel, was grieved in my spirit within my body. The visions of my head troubled me. I came near to one of those who stood by and asked him the truth of all this. So he told me and made known to me the interpretation of these things. Oh, that's a relief. Going to get the interpretation. Unfortunately, it's not the complete interpretation. He says, verse 17, those great beasts which are four kings which arise out of the earth. Well, that's the New King James Version. Like we said last week, most translations point out it's shall arise. The King James Version says four kings which shall arise out of the earth. The NIV says four kings that will rise. The RSV, four kings who shall rise out of the earth. So all of this appears to be future. So simply saying, you know, the lion is Babylon. When Babylon was just about finished at this stage, you know, Belshazzar was the last king. You know, the clock had almost finished ticking for Babylon. You couldn't say, you know, the lion is Babylon which shall rise, referring to the historic Babylon, because it was over almost. Which is why really the whole chapter, I think, my belief would be, is future. You can certainly use lions and bears to identify the nation, but in terms of the activities, in terms of what's going to happen, in terms of the prophecies, it's future prophecy for our day today. There may be a foreshadow in the past, but the reality is really about now, give or take a bit. Verse 18, but the saints of the Most High shall receive the kingdom and possess the kingdom forever, even forever and ever. Now, Daniel's, you know, particularly interested in the the fourth beast, and he says, verse 19, then I wish to know the truth about, you know, the fourth beast, which was different from all the others, exceedingly dreadful, with its teeth of iron, its nails of bronze, which devoured, broke in pieces, and trampled the residue with its feet. Again, notice, it devoured, it broke in pieces, and trampled. Rome? Nope. Not Rome. Notice also it says, verse 19 there, it was different from all the others. Different? was Rome different to Greece or Persia or Babylon? Not that I know of. You know, different language, perhaps. Warfare might have been the military might have been a bit better equipped. But really, was Rome very different to other empires historically? Was it Gauls, basically, wealth and power? To me, Rome's like just another version of the empires of Assyria and Greece and Babylon. But Islam, the Islamic realm, is that different? I think so. Because it doesn't go out conquering for the reasons of wealth. It conquers in the name of Allah. It's a religious conquering organization. So I think you could say the Islamic Empire is very different, and it does break in pieces and crush. So that's verse 19 to verse 20. And Daniel's curious about the 10 horns that were on its head and about the other horn which came up, before which three fell, namely that horn which had eyes and a mouth which spoke pompous words, whose appearance was greater than his fellows. What's this all about? I was watching in the same horn, the papacy or the Islamic Antichrist, take your pick, was making war against the saints and prevailing against them until the Ancient of Days came, and a judgment was made in favour of the saints of the Most High, and the time came for the saints to possess the kingdom. Well, it says here, verse 21, this horn was making war with the saints. And if this is future, which I believe it is, what are we looking at there? Well, if it's the Pope in the Vatican, we're probably seeing somehow that the Catholic Church is going to start some sort of issue with Sabbath keepers. If you're not working on Saturday and keeping Sunday, that's sort of what you're looking for there. Seems a little bit unlikely, I've got to say. On the other hand, if it's the Islamic Antichrist, well, at the moment, you'd have to say that Christianity of any shape and size in the Middle East has almost disappeared. The Islamic countries, Syria, Iraq, Iran, Saudi Arabia, where Islam is strong, Egypt, North Africa, anything to do with the name of Christ, the God of the Bible, is being eliminated. Anybody who acknowledges God the Father, Jesus Christ, that Jesus is the Messiah, if you do that anywhere in the Islamic realm, you are in trouble. And by the looks of it, more to come. Okay, let's go down to verse 23. So the angel is about to explain to Daniel's interest what this fourth beast is. Thus he said, "The fourth beast shall be the fourth kingdom on earth, which shall be different from all other kingdoms, and shall devour the whole earth, trample it, and break it in pieces." Is that Rome? I've said before, I don't see it. Is it Islam? I do see it, because that's the Islamic realm's historical method to obliterate, destroy religion, even language and alphabet. Legacy, history, it's what they do. They pulverize and destroy. But notice it does say, shall devour the whole earth. So there is a question mark there about, well, how far will this fourth beast extend its power? Well, you say, well, over the whole earth. But that's actually not necessarily what you and I would mean by the whole earth. So keep your place there, but turn to Daniel 2. Let's read verses 37 to 39. Same book, same prophet, using same language. So could the whole earth be the whole earth? Yeah, of course it could. Is it necessarily the whole earth? Must we look for the Islamic realm to necessarily extend its power absolutely everywhere around the earth? Australia, New Zealand, South Africa, Alaska, Canada, Russia, China, Japan, Thailand. Or could it be a bit more limited than that? Well, look at Daniel 2, read verses 37 to 39. This is, of course, the dream of the great statue. And Daniel says, this is the dream. Now we will tell the interpretation of it before the king, King Nebuchadnezzar. You, O king, are a king of kings, for the God of heaven has given you a kingdom, power, strength, and glory. And notice, wherever the children of men dwell, or the beasts of the field and the birds of the heaven, he has given them into your hand, and has made you ruler over them all. You are this head of gold. Well, question. Was Nebuchadnezzar actually over the millions living in China, Japan, Tibet, Nepal, Russia, North and South and Central America? Of course he wasn't. It meant that in the realm of Babylon, Nebuchadnezzar was the boss man. And then carrying on, verse 39. But after you shall arise another kingdom inferior to yours, then another, a third kingdom of bronze, which shall rule over all the earth. Well, okay, did Persia, did Greece rule over all the earth? No, they didn't rule over China and Russia and North and Central and South America, Australia. Of course they didn't. So all the earth doesn't mean necessarily the whole world. It means the within the realm of the prophecy, within the territory to which the prophecy relates. So in the territory which God is discussing in the prophecies, in that territory, all of that territory, then Nebuchadnezzar and the Medo-Persians and the Greeks and the Islamic realm, etc., etc., they rule over all of that. So back to Daniel 7. And we're reading verse 24 again. 23, sorry. The fourth beast shall be a fourth kingdom on the earth, which shall be different from all other kingdoms, as Islam is, and shall devour the whole earth, trample it, break it in pieces. That could be, and in context with Daniel 2, appears to be more a more restricted territory. So the realm of the prophecy, not necessarily something we should look out for necessarily. I'm leaving it open, by the way, because a caution when we move away from, you know, clarity of Scripture. For it need not necessarily be a worldwide empire. I suspect it won't be. Verse 24. The ten horns are ten kings. Well, there you are. What are the ten horns? Ten kings. The ten horns are ten kings, which shall arise from this kingdom, and another shall rise after them. He shall be different from the first ones, and shall subdue three kings. He shall speak pompous words against the Most High, shall persecute the saints of the Most High, shall intend to change times and law. Okay, that's what the narrative says, so we should be familiar with the narrative, but, you know, what does it mean? And traditionally, if you've grown up in the Church of God area, the ten horns of verse 24, the ten kings, are said to be ten kings who've come out of the old Roman Empire, which suffered a deadly wound in 476 AD. You'll have read that the papacy uprooted the first three. They were known as the Vandals, the Heruli, and the Ostrogoths. And then seven more kings arose over the next sort of 1,500 years from the time of Justinian in 554 AD, all the way through various kings up to Charlemagne and to Napoleon. And then the ninth one we've heard was Italy under Garibaldi up to Mussolini. And there's one more to come. If you want the list, you can find it in, you know, the booklet Who is the Beast? Or the old correspondence course. Give you a chart with all these 10 kings who come sort of not immediately one after the other, but there's one, then there's a passage of time, another, a few more decades, another, maybe a century or two, another, a couple hundred years, another, So they come strewn over the best part of, 1,500 or more years. That always seemed a wee bit contrived to me, because I was never comfortable how you identified Charlemagne as one of them, or Charles the Great as one of them, the Habsburg dynasty, or how did you, I don't know about that really. It seems a bit sort of like all these different kings who've lived across Europe, and you plucked out, five or six of them as being the horns. Okay. But that's the traditional view we've got. Okay, this is a historic reference here. It covers the last couple of thousand years. And over time, one after another, after another, after another, we've had some nine kings and one more left to come. So if you believe in the fourth beast is Rome, we're really saying this chapter is sort of actually old history now. Much of it's the past. The other option, the alternative option, is of course that this fourth beast, the terrible beast that stamps on, tramples, and breaks in pieces, is the Islamic Empire, with 10 kingdoms uniting together at this very end time, combining forces under a powerful Islamic leader or antichrist, pompous guy, who subdues or subjugates three of these kingdoms. Because look at verse 24. The 10 horns are 10 kings or kingdoms who shall rise from this kingdom, and another shall rise after them. Now, what's puzzling here in a sense is it does say that the little horn arises after the 10 kings. That's what it says in mine anyway. The 10 horns of 10 kings who shall arise from the kingdom, and another shall arise after them. Well, the traditional view you and I have had is that the little horn pops up after the first three and is around before number four, number five, number six, and seven, and eight ever come along. Because the papacy allegedly, pops up around about the 500s AD. Well, that doesn't appear to be what the Bible says. It says the little horn pops up after the 10. So I'm saying there that you have to have the 10 kingdoms first. And perhaps roughly the same time, the Islamic Antichrist individual comes up and for some reason subjugates three of those and then, leads the whole 10. Then notice verse 25. He, this individual, either the papacy from, 1600 years ago, or the yet-to-come Islamic Antichrist leader, shall speak pompous words against the Most High, shall persecute the saints of the Most High, shall intend to change times and law. Traditional view here is that the papacy and the Roman Catholic Church changed the Sabbath to Sunday a long time ago, of course. And also, to an extent, tinkered with the Ten Commandments, so, God's law, because they sort of abbreviated the Second Commandment about making no graven images, so you can't see those words usually in the summary version of the Ten Commandments, because, as we all know, they have statues everywhere to Mary and saints, and they sort of pray to them. So therefore, although you can find the full commandment in the Ten Commandments and in sort of the actual Bible, in the summary versions in the Catholic churches, you won't see the words about graven images. So, okay, they tinkered with the Second Commandment, and then, of course, they split the Tenth Commandment into thou shalt not covet thy neighbour's wife as one commandment, and thy neighbour's, ox, camel, ass, Maserati in the next commandment. So that's a sort of teaching, basically. The Catholic Church changed times and law. Basically the Sabbath and tinkering with the commandments. Well, it does say here, at the end of verse 25, he shall intend to change times and law. Well, actually the Catholic Church didn't intend to do that, they did it. It had done it a long time ago. But actually, think about it, there's minimal effect today on the world because most people across Europe, the UK, certainly, perhaps large portions of America, don't keep the Sabbath or Sunday and couldn't care less. Europe pretty much is identified now as a post-Christian continent. It's pretty secular. So, okay, that's what we traditionally thought. A alternative view is that changing, intending, shall we say, proposing, hoping to change times and laws, well, what about Islam? Well, yes, because the Islamic people, Islam, wants to see Sharia law worldwide. Sharia law is the law based on the teachings of the Quran and the Hadith, the traditions of Muhammad. Sharia law is proper law, and it affects, in Islamic countries, economics, politics, banking, business, sexuality, family life, social issues. It is comprehensive. And all Muslims want to see Sharia law. Even in the US of A, you know, sort of vaguely biblical nation, over 50% of Muslims there would prefer to see Sharia law across America. So if Islam gets its way, wherever it gets its way, it'll change the law. Whatever you've got, common law, Napoleonic law, sorry, it'll be Sharia law. Times. Well, actually, Islamic countries, strangely enough, follow the Islamic calendar. Not the Georgian calendar that we do. The Islamic calendar is based on the life of Muhammad, of course. It's a mandatory for Muslims to follow the Islamic calendar. It's where the holy days are all to be found, etc. It started with Muhammad's flight from Mecca to Medina back in AD 622, making this year that we're now in year number 1437. Right. 1437. Since the, what they call the Hijra, H-I-J-R-A. And of course it works off the lunar months, not the solar lunar calendar that the Hebrew calendar does. So basically, yep, the Muslims want to change the calendar and change to Sharia law. And while we're at it, by the way, let's change the holy day to Friday. So rather than having what we're all used to as a weekend, where some of us keep Saturdays, some keep Sundays, let's change that too and forget all that. Friday is the holy day. So therefore, if you're looking at changing the times and the law, I would suggest that the Islamic intent, the Islamic objective and goal, much better fits that than does the Catholic attempt to change Sabbath to Sunday 1600 years ago. Then carrying on, so verse 25, he shall speak pompous words against the Most High, shall persecute the saints of the Most High, shall intend to change times and law. Then the saints shall be given into his hand for a time and times and half a time. Ooh, that's basically 3.5 years. So he will persecute, make war against the saints for 3.5 years. Which, if you think about it, is pretty much what we read in Daniel 9:27. Remember, the Antichrist has the 7-year treaty. Halfway through it, in other words, with 3.5 years to go, he stops his sacrifices, he erects an abomination of desolation. Jesus said, when you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet, you head for the high ground, because there's going to be great trouble then, such as had never been before on the earth. So get moving. And this is it here. 3.5 years, time, times and half a time, as the Islamic Antichrist comes to the fore. So you might be saying, well, yeah, okay, you know, I see some of this, but, you know, Daniel is, at the end of the day, Old Testament. But we've already said, surely, it's quite clear that prophecy is for the end times. in Daniel. He was told to seal up the words until the time of the end, to go his way. These things were for the end times, the latter days. And some people say, yeah, well, it was all fulfilled in 70 AD. You know, the Romans came and destroyed the sanctuary and the city, didn't they? And, of course, it was a Roman general, but the actual legions were composed of local men from Syria, Egypt, and around there. So they say, well, all of this stuff took place in 70 AD. It was all fulfilled. Nothing for the future. Well, of course, the answer is that actually, guys, these beasts reappear in the last book of the Bible, the book of Revelation, which was after 70 AD. So let's turn to Revelation 13. Read verses 1 to 10. Which won't get very far, of course, but lay the groundwork for next time we come together, which will be in a couple of weeks, by the way, because we're not here next week, as you know. So Revelation 13, this is after 70 AD, so we're not talking here about everything was fulfilled when the Romans destroyed Jerusalem and the temple. So here we are, picking up in chapter 13. We'll read verses 1 to 10, then I might just hit a couple of points before we pack in. Revelation 13, John is in the day of the Lord, etc., writing down what he sees. Then I stood in the sand of the sea, and I saw a beast rising up out of the sea, having 7 heads and 10 horns, and on his horns 10 crowns, on his heads a blasphemous name. Now the beast which I saw was like a leopard. His feet were like the feet of a bear, his mouth like the mouth of a lion, and the dragon gave him his power, his throne, and great authority. So what we see here appears to be a composite of the beasts of Daniel 7. Because we have 7 heads on this beast, well, okay, back in Daniel we had one head on the lion, one head on the bear, 4 heads on the leopard, 1 head on the great and terrible beast, making 7 heads. This beast here is 7 heads. The beast in Daniel had 10 horns on the terrible beast. This beast has 10 horns. Verse 2 says here, this beast has bits of a leopard, feet like a bear, mouth like a lion. Well, of course, the beasts in Daniel 7 were a lion, a bear, a leopard, and the great and terrible one. So this is a composite of those beasts of Daniel 7. So Daniel 7 is important, because without Daniel 7, it'd be a struggle to really understand Revelation 13.
Absolutely.
You know, you have to sort of, you know, bring them together. Now, the traditional view, of course, is that this is the Roman Empire.
Oh, dear.
The Roman Empire that stretched over the past nearly 2,000 years or 1,600 years, right? Up until the fall of Napoleon in 1814. If that is the case, then really it's not too important because it's history. If this is describing the Roman Empire of, you know, something or other to Napoleon's fall, then who cares? It's history. However, if it's actually prophecy, and this is the here and now, and this is the end time Islamic Empire we're talking about, then suddenly it becomes like, ooh, this is future. This is living for today. This beast is one we need to know about because this is talking about what's going to happen in our time. It says the dragon gave him his power, his throne and great authority. This is Satan's beast. And by the way, Allah is Satan. If you come in the name of Allah, you'll come in the name of Satan. So let's call it as it is. Verse 3, I saw one of his heads as it had been mortally wounded. His deadly wound was healed. All of the world marveled and followed the beast. Well, the deadly wound, traditionally, is when Rome was sacked in 476 AD. Don't think so. So they worshipped the dragon who gave authority to the beast. They worshipped the beast, saying, who is like the beast, who is able to make war with him? So here's a powerful military empire That is, you don't want to go up against it. He was given a mouth speaking great things and blasphemies, and was given authority to continue for 42 months. Well, traditionally, this is the Vatican running from 554 AD, the imperial restoration, when Justinian was crowned by the Pope, and it ran till 1814 AD, when Napoleon fell. That's the 1260 years. Well, in which case, it's history, it's a limited relevance, you could argue. I prefer to read this the way it reads, which says that in this end time, this Islamic beast empire is given authority to continue for 3.5 years. 42 months. We've come across 3.5 years already. It's the last part of the 7 years when the abomination set up. It's mentioned a number of times. So I see this as applicable to our day today, when this beast with the Islamic Antichrist heading it, who's given this blasphemous mouth, that he has power to continue for 3.5 years. Verse 6, he opened his mouth in blasphemy against God to blaspheme his name, his tabernacle, those who dwell in heaven. It was granted to him as the leader of this Islamic empire, this Islamic realm made up of 10 united nations, to make war with the saints, to overcome them. And authority was given to him over every tribe, tongue, and nation, and all who dwell on the earth will worship him, whose names have not been written in the book of life of the Lamb, slain from the foundation of the world. If anyone has an ear, let him hear. He who leads into captivity shall go into captivity. He who kills with the sword must be killed with the sword. Here is the patience and the faith of the saints. So this first beast of Revelation 13, once again, I believe, is the end-time Islamic empire. It's composed of 10 kingdoms, 10 nations, who give their power unto this Islamic Antichrist ruler, who subjugates at least 3 of them. We read that back in Daniel 7, I think. Who's given power and authority over the saints, the, quotes, Christians, for it says here 42 months in verse 5, and back in Daniel 7, it said a time, times, and half a time. It's the same thing. It's, I think, quite consistent, so quite clear. So rather than seeing Revelation 13 as a sort of a history about, you know, various kings coming out of the Roman Empire, spread over many, many centuries, up to the fall of Napoleon in 1814. I don't really see the relevance of that. And I think it's contriving things to say 1260 years fits in there somewhere. To me, this is far more clearly a reference to the end time events that we've already read about in Daniel 8, 9, and earlier in 7. Which, of course, brings us up to this other beast, the end of chapter 13. And, of course, the rather infamous and curious mark of the beast. Wonder what that could be. If it's Islam, what's the mark of the beast? Or is it really keeping Sundays? Or is it a chip in your arm or your forehead? Well, we might cover that next time. Okay, folks, that's probably it for today. Remember, I said earlier, we're not here next week. So it'll be 2 weeks from today when we're back on the air. But that'll conclude today's Bible study.